Welcome to the Book Review Podcast.
I'm Sarah McSooley,
and I'm here today with Emily Meredith and Will Kostakis, author of The Sidekicks.
Hi, everyone.
Will, could you tell us a bit about the inspiration for this book?
So, The Sidekicks is my third novel for young adults, but I like to think of it as my second novel because when I moved over to Penguin, I sort of got a second chance and I sort of thought about what kind of books I wanted to write, and I changed my pen name from William Kostakis to Will Kostakis, so it was sort of like a rebranding. So when it came time to write this second book, I still didn't know what exactly makes a Will Kostakis book, in the same way that when you go to a library and pick up a Jeffrey Archer book, or you pick up a J.K. Rowling book or a Terry Pratchett book, you sort of know what to expect. I didn't really know what my brand was. Now, the first third was a book about growing up in a small but potent Greek family, and I thought, okay, is that going to be my shtick for the next 30 years? Am I just going to write Wog Boy stories and just, you know, write that once or twice? Then when people ask, hey, Will, stretch your wings a bit, maybe I'll write about an Italian family instead and then just keep doing that. But, you know, I'm just recycling family anecdotes. But I wanted to do something else, and it was during a conversation with my publisher that I realized that what made the first third so special as a book was that it was honest. And I really felt like I was putting myself down on the page, even though it was largely fictional, more fictional than most people assume, it still felt like I was representing a part of myself and a lot of my feelings. And so I started to think about the things I could be honest about. And in my life, I like to say that there have been two really formative experiences. The first was my parents' absolutely spectacularly horrible divorce, and the fact that my dad did a runner and I was raised by my mother and my grandmother. And that really informed the first third. The other formative experience was that when I was in year 10, my best friend passed away. And so that was always an idea that I wanted to write, but I never felt like I was good enough to write it. And I hinted at it in my first book, my proper first book, that I published when I was 19. But even though I had all the emotions there and they were quite fresh, I didn't really have the emotional intelligence to actually put it onto the page. I was still very guarded about what I published. And so this time I was like, right, I really want to unpack that situation and those feelings. And so I had my starting point, and I'm like, great, I'm writing another book about death. But it was, to make this one different, I really thought back to the things that I wanted to explore. What everyone seemed to really love about the first third, it had all that Greek hilarity, but underneath that, there was that really wonderful friendship between Styx and Billy. And so I thought, I want to explore male friendship. So I thought, right, okay, those are the pieces. It's male friendship in that tumultuous period of grieving as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old boy in a really uptight, super Christian, all-boys school. And that ended up becoming The Sidekicks.
Wow. I mean, I loved the first third.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's hard to say fast.
I know. Just say it like four times. Yeah, I know.
And if you're talking about your brand before, and I would say I think you've got it nailed. Like, I think your brand is that if you
really
pick
bleak,
up,
sad books.
Not at all. No. I was gonna say you pick up a Will Kostakis book, you know you're gonna get laughs. You know you're gonna get an equal amount of laughs as raw emotion.
Yeah. And it's not all doom and gloom. It's uplifting at the end.
That was the thing. Whenever I caught myself being too gloomy, I'd always put on Beyoncé's EXO, which is like the most sort of, okay, I'm in a bleak moment, but I'm just going to be like, I love everyone, yay. And so that always, like as corny as it sounds, that always righted where I was misstepping in terms of tone, because I really wanted people to put the book down and feel like there is a heaviness that runs through the book, but that slowly eases and just feel light and relieved and hopeful for the future.
That is exactly how I felt at the end of the book. It is exhilarating, like at the end of the book. It's just perfect.
Now, are three main characters and they're all very, very different. Mm-hmm. Did you base them on your own friendship group or is it all just a little bit of you?
So the book itself, the situation of it was based on my personal experience where my best friend passed away, but he was that sort of central force in the middle of a group. I like to joke that, you know, we were the moons and he was the planet. And then sort of when he was gone, we had nothing to orbit. In real life, it took about a week or so and we sort of found our groove as a friendship group. Obviously, that's too short a time to make an interesting book. And so I wanted to show them gradually coming together and becoming friends. But I know how, like when you watch TV and you watch films, characters are always really, really different. But in real life, your friends aren't really all that different from each other and you all sort of sound the same anyway. Like, sure, there are a couple of, you know, quirks in the way that you speak, but really most people sound the same if you've grown up together for 5 or 6 years. So, but for the book, I had to create completely original characters. And in the same way that I did with the sidekicks, the first third, where you had Billy and Styx, where I like to imagine them as two halves of me. You have my shy, reserved side, and you have the outgoing, zanier side, and they always bounce off each other. So when they have a conversation, that's more like my thought process put down on the page. So with these three, I was like, okay, what are the three archetypes that I want to work at? And I wanted to pick three of the most blatantly stereotypical representations of 16, 17 year old boys. And then unpack that and show their depth. So the first one was the swimmer. And so I wanted to look at that. So I was like, okay, he's the swimmer, but he's the swimmer with a secret. And he's that sort of thoughtful swimmer. And then I had the rebel. And so the rebel is very much, he was always going to have a heart of gold somewhere hidden underneath there. But as the drafts developed, he became funnier and funnier because of his placement in the middle of the book. Whenever I'd give it to test readers to read, they'd be like, oh, I'm always putting the book down at this bit because it's not that it's boring, but it's just like, meh. So he ended up getting redrafted into this massive, selfie-obsessed smartass. And once I found that voice, it was just so much fun to write him.
He was my favourite.
I can't decide who my favourite is. I change my mind all the time. I do think Harley is a bit of a, takes the spotlight.
Yeah.
I liked Harley so much because he was a boarder and I myself was a boarder.
Is it believable as
very
boarder? Because like, that was the scariest thing.
I didn't actually board at a Sydney school though. Oh, okay. So it's how I imagine a Sydney school would have been, but I was in the country.
All right. And so finally is the nerd. And so he is very distant, very focused on grades, and that was very much the kind of kid I always wanted to project myself as. When I was younger, and I was like, you know, I'm that straight-laced kid. And then I'm like, yeah, it's interesting as a character, but I also wanted to have an absolutely evil Machiavellian streak. And so he does all these evil plots that, you know, you sort of dream up as a kid in year 10, but you never actually act out. I got him to do all them and it was hilarious.
Every time I was reading, I had to keep jumping, being like, did that happen? What?
Yeah.
When he was rewriting history and stuff in his flashbacks and flash forwards. I loved Miles. Yeah. But I loved how vulnerable he was because he had these moments where you just realise how deeply he's feeling it. And it comes as such a surprise because up until that point, like you said, he's been a Machiavellian mastermind.
So my whole intent was I always knew that Miles was going to be the surprise heart of the story. I don't want to spoil why it becomes like that, but his part of the book I actually wrote when I was in year 12. It was my major work for Extension 2 English in the New South Wales HSC system. So it was very much, and that was based on my own personal experiences where I recorded a film with my best friend and I was very much like, oh, I'm going to do this all. I'm going to be like best director, best editor, best actor, all that sort of stuff. And so I picked all my friends to be sort of the lame duck group. And so I'm like, I'm just going to do it all. I'm going to get all the glory. And the movie premiered to no applause, but all the judges loved it. And I won all the awards except for best actor because I'm a terrible actor. And after my friend passed away, I was left with all this raw footage of me being a horrible dictator director and them going, Will, we hate you. And then after he passed away, I was like, oh, what if I actually believed all that stuff that he said? And so that informed this really vulnerable story that I wrote in year 12 and then expanded on in the sidekicks. But because I knew that was coming at the end, I wanted to be like, okay, you know what? I'm going to make everyone just absolutely hate Miles in the first two. You see sort of brief glimpses of that humanity, but
he's... Ryan seems to sort of be the first to really like... Yeah. And there's at one point in the book he's saying to Harley, oh no, you know, he grows on you.
Like, yeah.
I thought that was cute.
But the other thing about Ryan is that he is completely oblivious to so much. Like, he's so much in his own head. Like, he doesn't talk about the way that Isaac in the book passes away. He just doesn't. He's just got the blinkers on. It's like, oh, this is such a tragedy. I don't know how this happened. There were no warning signs. And it's not the case.
And it's really interesting as well how each boy has his own section. But we learn more about the accident and the events that led to Isaac's passing through each section. It's not all in one go.
Yeah. My first draft, there was no saying how he passed away, any of that. It was just very, very, very implied. And that really wasn't working. So people were reading going, what on earth is happening? And so I went back and I was guided by my editor and we really beefed that up a bit. And so it was really nice to see. So in the first part, he's very much put on a pedestal and gone, look at how wonderful a friend he was. Because he was to some people, you know. But I like this idea that while we can be the martyr in one person's story, we can be the unintended villain of someone else's, and we can all still call each other friends.
Yeah.
So I wanted to look at that sort of dynamic.
Well, Isaac's so present in the book for a character that we never actually... who is... passed away from the beginning of the story. He's so present, and he really ends the book with such a strong idea of who he was, good and bad, which I think is a real achievement to do that with a character that doesn't actually appear in real time in the book.
Thank you.
Yeah, I thought that was a cool part.
It was all amazing.
It really was. It was a great book, and it's. You started off before saying that it was same, but different from the first third, and I really feel that. There's so many echoes between the two. You can sort of see...
They're both stories about people coming together and being brought together through death, where the first third, it is very much about a character fighting the inevitability of an older family member's passing. And sort of in the lead up to that, you know, resisting that, but then also bringing his family together. The sidekicks is about that sort of unexpected death and then how, you know, without any... What happens with the first third is that there's a list for this is how you get your family back together, and there are sort of set... There's like a checklist of this is what you do and they'll come together. Whereas with the sidekicks, it's very much more organic and just how we sort of fall into each other's lives without realising. And that was what I really wanted to do. So it's a book with no chapters, and I like to pitch it as three novellas sort of back to back, where you could read each of them tell their own complete story.
I like that.
And I wanted it to read sort of in the rhythms of life. So yeah, I'm gonna stop rambling now.
That's what podcasts are all about. Yeah. Ramble away.
I'm just so excited because I don't think there are enough books with young, like, teenage male protagonists. So I'm so excited that there's finally one I can recommend to all of the desperate parents.
It is always the hardest recommendation, isn't it?
It is.
Someone's like, I've got a teenage boy, what do you... And, like, your mind goes blank. And you're like, the Piper's Son. And then everything else falls out of your head. But, yeah, this is a surefire hit.
Thank you very much.
And I don't even normally like, I'm not a huge fan of changing perspectives. Because I find I fall in love with one character and then I don't want to let them go. And the next one comes along and they've missed that window. Yeah. I'm not invested. But in this one, instantly, like every change of character was like, I don't want to let go of Ryan. But hey, who are you, Harley? And then you're off.
I think it comes from not having that alternating chapter to chapter.
Yeah.
So for me, when I'm reading YA, like, and especially, or at least early on, some of them do it really, really well, but sometimes it'll just be, now we're going to show the same scene from this character's perspective immediately, and it always feels like a gimmick almost. So I wanted to avoid that, and I really wanted to just get in these kids' heads, and the characters never disappear from the story. they just flow in organically whenever we need them.
You have to let them go.
Yeah, you just see a different perspective of them. Yeah. That just makes you love them more. What was the most challenging aspect for you? Was
making the voices sound different. I always go into each of my projects thinking, how am I going to challenge myself this time? And that getting those different voices was the big challenge. I wanted them to sound like people I didn't know. So I've always made fun of authors who are like, oh, my characters speak to me and I carry them with me and I just write down what they tell me. And I'm like, you're a crazy person. And now I've become that author where it's like, I finished writing the book a couple of months ago and now I still feel like I'm carrying them with me and I can hear their voices and they just feel so fully formed. So that was the biggest challenge for me, but also the part of the book that I just enjoy the most.
I have this question and it's hilariously, it's not actually about the sidekicks. It's about the first edit.
Yep, that's fine.
But, I remember when I first read it and then I reread it again recently. Yeah. I just thought that if I ever had the chance, I would ask you, Peter, why was he, like, do you know why?
Okay, this is interesting. So Peter is the younger brother and he's a little bit angsty and he's modeled on my younger brother who has been struggling with teenage angst for 15 years now, which
right,
is great.
That's
like,
a long
it's like, hey, how are you? Oh, go away, you don't even lift. So, you know, and this was an argument I had with my editor every single time she read the book. She's like, we want to know what's wrong with him. And I'm like, I know. I live with a Peter and I don't know. I am trying. And it was that, it got to the point where it was like, she was like, oh, let's give him depression. And I'm like, I don't want to identify it because, one, I don't think the person I initially modeled him on has depression, but two, we don't know everything about everyone and life doesn't give us these neatly packaged reasons. Like, this is why this person 3 years ago was the worst person to you. Like, sometimes we don't get that answers, and that frustration I really loved. I feel that frustration too. So, it's funny, readers always bring that up with me and they're like, we're frustrated. We hate him because we don't know what's wrong with him. I'm like,
no, but I think it really works. I just thought if I ever sat down with you, I would have to ask, do you know? Or is it just something that you never...
I don't know. And I didn't want to know. Because there's always that point in my writing where if I have based someone originally on someone in my life and then it slowly becomes fictionalized, by the time they become that fictional person, I've usually made all those decisions. But with Peter, I think it was that ambiguity of not knowing what was going on in his head, he only had one that I know of, although I could just, you know, 10-year anniversary, just be like, what if Peter had two heads and just re-release it with a different cover and call it Life and Death.
Please don't ever do that. Or
I'll just gender switch.
I think that that's, though, one of your greatest strengths is that when in your writing, you do have an ability to make it seem like it's just a slice of life. Mm. Everything feels really authentic and, you know, it's not like, and here's your packaged up character with depression and here's your packaged up character who fits in that little box. Everyone sort of, you know, feels really real.
But it's that bit of ambiguity. That's what makes a text exciting because we all bring our personal experiences to a text. Like the amount of people, so I wrote about a yaya, so a Greek grandmother who is very much my grandmother, but I've had people of different ethnicities, different walks of life, different ages coming up to me saying, I have this person in my life. And it's that ambiguity in the way that I've drawn her. They've been able to apply their own maternal figures to that character. So
Definitely. I have a very imperious grandmother who's got a big personality but is not Greek and does not cook moussaka or anything like that.
They're not mutually exclusive. Like,
it's more the love. It's the love that all of the characters felt for her in that book is, you know, really relatable because...
And that's been my big motivation when I'm writing young adults is I love writing adult characters, but not simply because, oh, I'm getting older, I have to put an adult in there. I really love that intergenerational relationship, and that's it was one of the really, really strong parts of the first third. It's not as central in the sidekicks, but you know,
it's
that
there.
It's there,
yeah,
and it's
Sue and...
I really like, I love getting to know the teachers and seeing the teachers.
I
as
love Ryan's mom.
Ryan's mom is a hit. Like, she is hilarious.
It was really good as well to see those adult characters, because a lot of the problem with young adult in articles and so on is that the adults are never present.
Yeah.
So it seems like these children are just running around being crazy people and they have no paternal influence.
And the thing is, as young adults, I'll classify myself as a young adult because I'm still 12. But young adults are always told, well, my voice hasn't dropped yet, so we're still waiting for that one. Just one day we're like, hi, I'm Will. Puberty happened. All the rest of it. Oh, terrible. Now I'm just going to be laughing the whole way. But as young adults, we're always told, you know, we're what's wrong with society. We, you know, we have the wrong attitudes, you know. If only we just saved up more, bought a house, you know, we just demand too much, all that sort of stuff. But the young adults that I meet whenever I visit schools are probably the greatest people I have ever met. Just completely open, completely just not prejudiced, just wonderful human beings, where if you catch them, you know, saying something, say, homophobic or racist, and explain to them, look, you know, that probably wasn't nice, they are not going to say, I have a right to be a bigot. That seems to be something that only happens to be
age,
yeah,
I guess.
Well, it's just odd. And some of the things I've overheard when I visit schools, the really horrible stuff is what I hear staff members say in the staff room when no one's listening and they think that it's acceptable. And it's just, I just wanted to show young adults that, hey, even adults, you know, can say things that aren't the best, and we're always constantly growing and changing and hopefully for the better.
I think so. And I mean, that's one of the draw cards of young adult literature, I think, is that you're writing about a group of people where everything is full of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that just makes for such great storytelling. Like, your characters are in a state of flux.
They're always on the cusp of something better, or, you know, they're on the edge of the rest of their lives. And I just love the tension of that.
Well, and you know, and the more I've been sitting here thinking in the back of my mind about the adults in the sidekicks, and they actually are, like, Miles' parents. How cool are Miles' parents?
Yeah,
they were awesome.
They were last-minute additions, because I was like, okay, so I had, you know, Ryan, he's raised by the single mum. Harley is raised by the single dad. I'm like, oh, what do I do with, you know, Miles' parents? You know, how do I make them different? I'm like, oh, wait, I should try writing a happily married couple for once. And it was... They had this, and originally it was just very plain and there was like nothing. I'm like, it feels like they need something there. And then I just added his mum just constantly taunting his father just about the fact that he used to be a triathlete and now he just disappoints her. And it was...
They were great.
It didn't help that one day my mum, you know, cut out a Target underwear model and used him as a bookmark. And I'm like, that's going in a book.
Excellent.
And she named him and I'm like, that's also going in a book. And then that was just, yeah.
No, they were great.
But because I needed the adults there, because I very much knew from the very beginning, this needs to be a book about boys grieving, and it needs to be an all-boys school, you know, to show that grieving, you know, in that sort of heightened environment. But then I'm like, I can't write a book with no women in it. And I'm very, you know, aware of diversity and different voices, not simply because we have to be diverse, but because diversity adds flavour to a book and it adds, you know, different tones and different perspectives. And so a lot of those adult characters, I found a lot of them came through as women. And obviously that's also informed by the fact that I was raised by women. And, you know, get me to write a coherent father figure. And I'm just like, I can't do this. Oh my God, what do dads do? I can't talk to other men. It makes me uncomfortable. Do I talk about sports? I can't catch. Thanks, Dad.
It's all nice.
This is where the podcast readers, listeners, are just sitting up going, this boy has issues.
I I still haven't been able to decide who my favourite character is. Your family.
Yes, Holly. But I see bits of myself in all of them, so it is tricky to pick.
Yeah, well, if I had to pick one, I would say Miles, only because I am very aware I make a terrible first impression. And so I associate with Miles the most, mostly because I like that idea that he gets it's a third chance that he gets, because he doesn't really get a second chance, he gets a third chance to sort of, you know, present who he is, and the reader gets to sort of make that judgment by the end and be like, oh, okay, you're not that heartless.
I want to ask, and I have to tread very carefully around this question because I don't want to spoil anything, but there is a kind of hypothesis of the future that happens towards the end of the book. And just, you know, this is only going to benefit me and, I guess, Emily, but like, and listeners, after you've read the book, this might be a great thing to know. But is that, do you think that would be the true way things unfold?
No. I will say that flatly, because I don't think it's as hopeful as it seems. I'm of the belief that it's very bittersweet, but I'll save that for another podcast after people have read it. But I would like to revisit these characters at some point. What I want to do is I want to write like 4 or 5 contemporaries that are very, very real world, and then pick characters from each and do an Avengers style crossover where they stop aliens, like just full on different genre, just complete like stuff continuity, and just throw them all in. So there are hints at the school that exists in the first third is mentioned in the Sidekicks. Yep. So they're part of the same. It's the same world. It's a couple of years later. So this book is set in 2015. The first third was set in 2012. And originally in the flash forward at the end, the flash forward was originally the future, and you were going to see a returning character from the first third, but I cut that out.
Oh my god, is this going to actually happen? Are we going to get a book with Bill and Lucas and all of...
Yeah. Oh, it's... There will be... I think I have the plot for it, and it's exciting, but also...
Is this far future? Like, do you have other... Can we ask about your next project? Are we allowed
My next book... I want my next book to... be radically different, mostly because
fantasy I'm, different.
Yes.
Characters with two heads.
Characters with two heads. Characters with fathers. No. So the big thing is that I find that I'm a method writer. So however my characters are feeling, I sort of live it, breathe it, write it, and. Speak to anyone, my mum, my editor. I've been in a really wonderfully dark place for the past 2 years, so I just want to write something that's a bit lighter, at least the first draft, and then add some heaviness in, but I need some time to just sort of regroup, and it's just something like The Sidekicks is particularly dense and very, but it's also... It's plotted, but in a way that doesn't feel plotted. I want to write something, because I love planning, and I love... you know, being a mile a minute page turner, and I'd love to have a go at that professionally, because I haven't really done that yet. So I did want to sort of dabble in, I'd say it's contemporary fantasy is what I was thinking of, but now that I've said it out loud, I probably won't write it. But that's what I'm, it'll either be a personal project for me just as a palate cleanser before I write the bleak next book.
I love how you keep saying that it's bleak. I think that there's so much hope in
there is so much
book.
Hope, but it's just, it's the first draft, there was no hope at all, and it was just really tough to write the first draft. So
we only get the
you only get the beautiful finished stuff. Like the original stuff is just like, oh my god, Will, why do you hate us?
You've been on a dark journey. We went on a great journey.
Lovely.
Yeah, it was. It's one of the original titles for it was The Light in Dark Places. And that was one of the things that ran through it. But obviously the first time I was writing it, it was just like all the dark places needed to be filled first before I could turn on the light. And so The Sidekicks is what happened when I switched on the light. So
it's a fantastic title, The Sidekicks.
Thanks.
It is. It's just like, honestly.
I just loved that once they announced it, everyone thought I was writing a superhero book for at least 3 or 4 weeks. It was really magical.
It does have that,
You
know. They're all superheroes in their own way.
That's a very long bow to draw, but okay. No, it's...
In the next book, when they get bitten by radioactive spiders.
Look, honestly, in terms of dream projects, I'd love to do... I can see what this crossover looks like. I know exactly what the second third looks like if I ever write that. So that's all very exciting. But the fear with a sequel or something like that is that you're sort of limited to the audience of the first book. So, or at least, you know, when you pick it up. I've certainly read some sequels that I didn't read the first one on. But in terms of building myself up as an author, I can't really run around going, this book is just for 5 of you. More than 5 people have read it. But, you know, I don't think it makes good business sense. As much as I would love to occupy these worlds for much longer, I don't think it makes good business sense to just keep sort of...
Returning to the same place,
yeah.
I love a good standalone book, though. I read so quickly, by the time a sequel comes out, I've forgotten what happened.
For me, I'm from the Terry Pratchett school of sequels, where the sequel needs to completely stand alone and be its own story. So,
yeah, no, cliffhangers don't do anyone any favours, I don't think. Yeah.
And that was... The Sidekicks is like my own little mini trilogy, where I get to do my 2 little cliffhangers, I get to tell my different stories, and I get to tie them all together, and...
Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today. It's been so fun.
Thanks very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
And I'm predicting huge things for the Sidekicks. I think there's so much buzz already.
And lots of fangirling will ensue, I'm sure.
Excellent.
And listeners, you can buy your copy, your signed copy, briefly. There are only a few available at Booktopia now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.